The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Hedra Packman, and I'm the Deputy Director of Library Services. I am truly honored to be here this evening to introduce the renowned children's author and illustrator, Tommy Ungerer. Tonight's event is made possible by the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. To learn how you can support the Free Library Foundation and more great programs like this one, please visit us on the web at freelibrary.org/support. Tommy Ungerer is a recipient of the prestigious Hans Christian Andersen Medal for Lifetime Achievement. He's published more than 140 books, including the popular and critically acclaimed children's books, Flicks, Crichter, and the Mellops series, as well as his more controversial works for adults. Tommy, Jean Thomas Ungerer, was born in Strasbourg, France, on November 28, 1931. The Nazi occupation of Alsace during Ungerer's childhood affected him deeply, leaving him with a strong aversion to war and fascism and a habit of questioning authority, which we've all noticed in his books. After some adventures, some schooling, and many travels, Tommy arrived in New York City in 1956 with exactly $60 and a trunk full of manuscripts and drawings. He was lucky enough to meet Ursula Nordstrom, the most famous editor. And in 1957, his first book, The Mellops Go Flying, was published. And very, very quickly, he gained success as a children's and an adult author, illustrator, and artist. Known for his sharp satire and outspoken support of humanitarian causes, Mr. Ungerer's body of work forms an important commentary on the social and political changes that have occurred in the second half of the 20th century. He is amazingly prolific, and he is a unique honor in that the Tommy Ungerer Museum is in his hometown of Strasbourg, France, and is dedicated exclusively to his life and his work. In 1968, Mr. Ungerer donated many of his manuscripts and artwork for his early books to the children's literature collection here at the Free Library, including the much-loved The Mellops series and some subversive classics like Moon Man and The Three Robbers. In a recent interview, Tommy said that his message for his American fans was, "Libraries are the most important institution in a democratic society," an idea that many of us share in this room. We are pleased that we have received a grant for the Council on Library and Information Resources to create finding aids for 6 of our finest children's literature collections in order to provide more access for researchers, students, and children's literature fans. These hidden collections of original works and manuscripts of well-known authors and illustrators, specifically Virginia Lee Burton, Evelyn Ness, Carolyn Haywood, Lloyd Alexander, Robert Lawson, and of course, Tommy Ungerer, will be cataloged, preserved, and digitized. An introductory exhibition featuring materials from our Ungerer collection is currently on display right outside the auditorium. Please take time to explore the exhibit if you haven't already. We are pleased that this is Tommy Ungerer's first trip to the United States since the 1970s. We hope the first of many. He currently lives in Ireland with his wife Yvonne, who is with us tonight, and we're glad to have her here too, as well as his daughter Aria. In addition, we are happy to welcome Peter Titiker of Fiden Press, who is reissuing and republishing many of Tommy's works in the United States. Tommy's wife said to me that he has a life in chapters, and we are hoping that this is the beginning of a wonderful chapter of coming back to the United States, sharing his knowledge, his background, his skill, and his just zest for living in life with all of us in the United States again. We're doubly honored this evening because Mr. Unger will be interviewed by Tony Auth, the Philadelphia Inquirer's Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist and an amazing illustrator of children's books himself. It's a pleasure and an honor to have them here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tony Auth and Tommy Ungerer.
Good evening, and first of all, I want to say how grateful we are that you've come to Philadelphia so that we can be a part of this wonderful birthday celebration that is going on all over the world. I'd like to open this up by asking you, you're trilingual.
Pardon?
You're trilingual. You speak three languages.
Yeah, right.
What is it like for a writer to be trilingual? And I understand that you write your children's books always in English. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I guess I arrived here in America, and I kind of started my career with writing and illustrating, drawing children's books, and I guess it's out of habit. And I must say, I love the English language, actually, because it's got so much more synonyms. I would say for every French word, you have about sometimes 10 other words in English. So you have it's like with colors, you know, you have a greatest array in the vocabulary. Now, in German, it's kind of lighter, because in German, you can take any two words and glue them together, and you get another word. That's very practical, too. But I don't know. The children's books definitely in English.
Now, you grew up in Alsace. You were a young boy, and it was under German occupation.
Well, no, it's not as simple as that. I mean, Alsace, you know, it's kind of one of those problematic countries. The Germans say it's German, and the French say it's French. But actually, I speak of another language, which is Alsatian, which is Alemannic, so which is like Old German or Yiddish too. Basically, it's a kind of same kind of language. And so we've been going back and forth. You see, my grandmother changed five times. So before the First World War, I was French. Then the Germans, or if you want to call it the Nazis, arrived. And then the French came back. So it's quite an experience, you know, to what you find out in the end, you find out that there's good people everywhere and there's advantages to every situation. And the dramas which you live, they just feed your life. I mean, I can say I had already my whole life's opinions, if you want to put it, was there, were already shaped when I was young. I'd seen the war, you know, we were for 3 months in the last German bridgehead, so it was really like battle, you know, digging trenches as a child, and I've seen the war just like an infantryman, and I had already been marked by death since my father died when I was 3 years old. So that's really deeply marked me, and really, as I said, you know, violence, oppression, tyranny, injustice, all the things I've been a witness to all that, and very early it's shaped my thinking and thus my work and my engagement. I've been always fighting for causes.
Right.
My life would be really, I would say, boring if I hadn't something to fight for. You know?
And so you were, what, 5, 6, something like that, when you started doing drawings?
Oh, very early. Yeah. Now, this is something that runs in the family. I mean, I have 3 nieces, for instance, who are authors and writers of and illustrators of children's books. But they're married, so they have another name, because always it might be a bit difficult. But it really runs in the family. And I've always been encouraged, right, very early. And my brothers and sisters, I was an accident in the family. I was born about 8 years later than my one brother and 2 sisters. And as a child, you know, they all taught me to draw. And already, you see, my father died when I was 3 and a half, and I always had a feeling he left me all his talents en bloc. And my father was really a genius in many ways. He was building astronomical clocks, which were already mechanically incredibly, astronomically extremely complex, but astronomical clocks, too, with sculptures, you know, which move. But he was a great writer. He wrote in German, French, and Alsatian, and as an artist, I would still say he was better than I am. It's unbelievable. And I discovered this much later. I was not brought up with my father's work as much. No, there were a few pieces around. But what was very, very important, I was brought up with my father's library. That's what really shaped me. And my love for books. I'm really a bibliophile, and I couldn't conceive a life without books. That's my great love in terms of objects, if one thing. I need my books. And I really educated myself with books because after the war, you know, as the Germans arrived, we had 3 months to learn German. I didn't speak a word of Germans when they arrived. And after 3 months, one word, even if you said a merci or a bonjour, you could be arrested for that and go to jail. So it was absolutely forbidden. I described this in a book, A la guerre comme à la guerre, which is used in history in the French schools. And so I learned that you can learn a language in 3 months if you have to. I mean, maybe, you know, by pointing a gun or a knife at a child, he might learn a language even in 2 weeks, you know. But then I lost 1 ear, you see. And then when the French came back, I mean, it was the same old story, you know. I loved literature. You know, I read old English, old German, and old French because I'm just fascinated with language. And I was reading authors which were not on the program under the French. And my French teacher will say, I have to translate, lose your accent before you get interested in literature. You know what I mean? This kind of... And not only this, our language, our real language, which was Alsatian, was forbidden by the French, you know. If you were caught even outside of school speaking your own language, you had to stay two hours, you know, after school, or just very simply slapped across the face. We were just Zahlbusch. We were always something, you know. So I know what it feels to be a minority, and that's what really drove me. Even to these days, I've been very, very instrumental in Europe. You know, the friendship between France and Germany, which made Europe. I mean, now it's fine, you know. I'm Alsatian, and I'm European, and I'm a French citizen. It's just fine like that. But I really fought, for instance, with my association, I did a lawsuit on France, so we would have the rights to teach Alsatian and German in primary schools and kindergarten. But then I've been working for many years with the French First Ministry of Culture and then Ministry of Education, where I've been very busy. And the Minister of Education, Jacques Lang, said, lose your lawsuit and I'll pass your law. So it's not that I'm just engaged with my drawings, you know, for actions. I mean, I get really laws passed, and I must say, I mean, how many people fight for a cause in this world and are persecuted, ended up in jail, and are never recognized for it? I've been very lucky. I've been decorated instead, you know.
Now, you came to the United States famously in 1956 with $60 and two trunk loads of manuscripts and drawings.
No, one trunk.
One trunk only.
It was the same trunk I had in the army.
I'm wondering what your impressions of this country were when you arrived, and then what your impressions were when 15 years later you left for Nova Scotia.
Well, it's very complex because I arrived in the middle of the McCarthy years, and I realized very soon that in one way you had the United States of America, and on the other hand you had New York, and all the people who kind of rebelled and all this all came in New York. Well, it took me a little while to find that out, but one shocking thing is my first wife came. Her father was sheriff of Amarillo, Texas. And within a year, we went there for Christmas to visit. And there was segregation. And for Europeans, that was shocking, I must say. I mean, this has been one of the greatest shocks of my life in those days, to see such blacks, you know. I mean, couldn't go in a restaurant and all that. So that was shocking. But, you know, I mean, in every country, you will find good and bad. You know, I'm the typical fairy tale of a success story. Arriving here, and I did a thing. The next morning after I arrived, I went into a newspaper stand and looked at the magazine I wanted to work for and wrote down the telephone number and the art director. And then I went off, and my office was a telephone booth. And that's how I started. And people were so nice everywhere. Not only nice, not only welcome, but one guy, remember, you know, at C. Jerome Snyder at Sports Illustrated, and say, oh, you got to see Harry Golden at CBS. So immediately on the phone, Harry, listen, there's this young French here, you know, you should look at his work and all that. I mean, an unbelievable story, a success story. Can you imagine? My first book was published within a year. And it won a prize, well, not the first prize of the Children Book Festival. And then Krichter the next year won really the prize. So it's all give and take, you know. And then, of course, I got involved against the war in Vietnam. Well, in those days, there was a war in Korea. I had nothing against that. Please, let's not forget one thing. If there hadn't been America, we might all be communists now. So that was a justified war and even so, I say too, you know, I'm a pacifist. But if there's something rising again, like fascism or something, one would have to fight. You know, it's very strange and ironical that actually you have to fight for peace. You know, it's a complete contradiction, but you have to fight for peace. And how do you do it? You do it with respect, I'd say, because that's still one of the things I haven't achieved. I had it started with the Ministry of Education in France, was to teach respect to children already in kindergarten. Teach respect of everything, food, the elderly, nature, money, everything, just respect. And I remember that in school when I was 7 years old, there was a text, you know, saying, you know, don't go into the wheat fields to trample the weeds. Then he said, child, do not kill your bread on its halm. It's translated from the French, but it's a wonderful thing. I was brought up with respect of bread. And anyway, in those days, we didn't have that much money, and after every meal, we had a little broom, and we collected the breadcrumbs after the meal, and then when there were enough, it was like what, nowadays you have cereals at breakfast all over the place, but that's the first cereal I ever had were breadcrumbs. And so I took off, and I started in New York with my drawings just like this under my arms, my bundles of drawings. And then it started raining, and I didn't have a box, so I went into a pharmacy. I went and asked for a box. They gave me a big cardboard box about that size where I fit my drawings in there, and it made a sensation. And I wonder if it didn't kind of one of the reasons of my success, nearly instant success in America, was not that box. You wouldn't have an idea what kind of box it was. It was a wholesale box for Trojan contraceptives. And everywhere I arrived, I would come, you know, and put my box of condoms on the guy's desk, you know, Madison Avenue. I was kind of known as a condom man, you know. But in a way, you know, I was inside the American society too, a kind of Trojan horse when you think of all the posters I did about the war in Vietnam, you know, and all that. So anyway.
But then you tired of this country, apparently, did you not? And when
you know, as times change, you know, like everywhere, and times change, and I don't really ask myself. You know, people ask me, how does it start with a children's book? I don't really know. I just have a flash, I have an idea, and I do my book, and that's it. I've done over 150 books now for adults, children, all kind of the biography, written or drawn. Because for one thing, it's a need. And then, too, I have to have my fun. And sometimes my fun is in shocking people. But in terms of children's books, I always did, you know, the kind of books that I would have liked as a child. And one of the great things in my childhood was how to overcome fear. I'm not talking about the wars, the bombs and all that, but I was very little and I was scared of darkness, and my brother on a moonlit night took me to the cemetery, and I overcame my fear of darkness to the point that I would sometimes wrap myself in a bed sheet and go into the streets. I thought I'd scare people, you know. Well, you do this at Halloween, I found out later. So there's always elements of fear in my children's books, because I think that children should be taught how to overcome fear. And I'm working on a project right now with the Ministry of Education in France, where they're going to ask in different schools, you know, what the children, let's say, between 5 to 7 or 8, what are you scared from? And then we're going to sit down in a committee and see how much, with as much humor possible, because I find that's the best way to fight against something is humor. With a joke, you always win. I always say that the first joke of the day is my crack of dawn. I don't know. No, that's Irish, isn't it? You don't say this in America, a joke, a crack. Yeah, you do?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Now, you stopped doing children's books, though, for 15 years.
Oh, at least, yeah.
And what got you back into children's?
Well, because there's so many titles, and I find really that, I mean, even you don't really need that many children's books. I think adult books are just as interesting. I mean, take a book on birds. And if you read to your children, you wouldn't hear hardly and tell stories. I mean, this is the best way to communicate with children, and especially to read them books which are ahead of their age, so that they ask all the time, what does it mean? What is this word? You know, I'm repeating myself endlessly by saying the same thing. I never would say a tree. I would say what kind of tree it is. This is an oak. Or a weeping willow. Oh, my God, a weeping willow. How many handkerchiefs does it need? You know, I mean, it's Kleenex, you know. A weeping willow is an advertising for Kleenex. And, you know, the same thing with birds, with flowers. A meadow beauty. Isn't that, you know, it's
very
beautiful
poetic
stuff. Yeah.
Now, you've talked a lot about how important doubt is to you. Do you try to write your books to instill doubt, or is that for kids or for adults or both?
Well, this is relative. I mean, this is my philosophy is the philosophy of doubt. Don't hope, cope. Don't hope, cope. This means really keep contact in reality to be able to cope with it. And my brand of doubt means why not. When you have this point of view, then everything is possible, everything is acceptable. And then it's not negative. It's not that I'm automatically putting something down. On the contrary, for me, doubt gives me a way of opening windows and doors. Because with doubt, I'm trying to understand the other person better or what it is all about. I don't know if I put really that much doubt in the children's book. I put more relativity. I know all the early children's books were all always about animals which are normally hated or put down, hated by human beings. You know, octopus, snake, rats, vulture, bats, and even the three robbers are outsider. And because basically, I mean, every human has something that the other one doesn't have. And our identity is our difference. And if we are aware of that and we can use whatever we have, then in all my stories, in the end, they all become heroes, you know. Because can you imagine all the things an octopus can do with eight arms? But I have one little joke in my book about Emil the octopus. In one drawing, I put only seven legs. And do you know how many children noticed it? And no adult, to my knowledge, ever noticed it. They're smarter than we are. We have to give them a hand on that one.
And you are the, I think, only living illustrator with his own museum.
Pardon?
How did that come about?
I'll just say that to answer your question, finally, we'll get to that. I stopped doing children's books because there were just too many of them.
Okay.
But then I did other kind of books, which are kind of family book, like the German song book, and all kind of, or even my autobiographies are illustrated, like my autobiography about my experience during the war and the fascism, which, as I said, is used in schools in France. Of course, in cheaper edition, you know, in paperback. But I had there the best, most beautiful compliment I ever had. A woman told me, she was reading my book, my autobiography, as a child to her son, and he slept with a book under his pillow. But after that, I started again. And I must say that all the last children books I've done in the last few years are all engagés. You know, like Otto is a story of a little Jewish boy and a German boy, and they lose their family in the war and meet again afterwards. And I show the war. The Blue Cloud, which hasn't been published yet in English, is about civil war. The last book I did, which is called Making Friends, is about a little black boy who arrives in a white neighborhood. And he cannot make friends. People are not aggressive, but he cannot make friends. So he decides to make his own friends, you know. He starts making sculptures and things, and then the little girl next door says, "Yes, but what are you doing?" He says, "I'm making friends." He says, "Yes, but they have no clothes. I have a sewing machine." they're both making friends, and all the other kids in the neighborhood says, "Come, what are you making? Why making friends? Can you show us how to make friends?" You know, this kind of thing. And then they're all engagé books, like happens in a city which is split by a river. And on one side of the city you have the dogs, and on the other side you have the cats, you know. And finally they have elections and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there's plenty of authors, but anyway. Now, the last book I did in those days, that was for this wonderful woman, Ursula Nordstrom. And I really want to give my homage to the woman who gave me my first chance in life, which was Ursula Nordstrom at Harper and Row. She started Maurice Sendak, and she was open.
Shel Silverstein, I believe.
Yeah, well, I brought Shel Silverstein.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. Shel, someday, come on, you should put some of your songs in children's books, and let's go and see Ursula Nordstrom. I brought Edward Gorey to Ursula. You know, really, this is a whole gang here. This is gangland here. Children's books gangland. So.
Now, about your museum, how did that come about? In Alsace?
Well, it's just that I donated my hometown, something like 12,000 drawings or something like that. And they always had a centre ungerer, you know. I never had to organize any of my exhibitions. I mean, it was always organized by the people working there. And finally, they had a meeting, and I got my own museum in Strasbourg, which is very unusual for France, because in France there is a law that no official museum should be financed until an artist dies. It's usually because there is, inheritance problems and all that. But since I had given so much, and my library as well, and my toy collection as well, so my toy collection, they still have to do a children's museum for that, you know, where they can use that inspiration with workshops. I really do believe that don't go in toy shops and buy toys for your kids. Buy them tools or pocket knife here, you know, like this. Buy them real, I mean, not toy tools, real tools, real drills, real things, so that they can, as I always say, and I'm repeating myself, we have a little brain at the end of every finger, and in a way we are what we make, we are what we do, and I think this should be really heavily encouraged with children creatively. And not only this, later on in life you save a lot of money if you can repair your own lawnmower.
How did you come to start collecting toys? These were old tin toys?
I was just given one day a tin toy. I'm very passionate. I get easily, completely, manically collecting something. It's whatever. It can be minerals. It can be all kinds of things. And when I'm finished, then I'm done with. And then as long as they stimulate me and give me ideas, you know. If you look Papa Snaps, there's a lot of my toys in there, which are turned, you know, indirectly. And what I like, that you have to be specific too there about toys, I would say, is a mechanic toys. And some of them in terms of, like automats, it's brilliant. The cams, the functioning, the engineering and all that. It inspires me in my sculptures and in some of my other works. I just designed for the French electricity works, Franco-German electricity works, kind of something I figured out, which is two rafts, which are anchored in either in a river. It's for the third world, energy for the third world. And I figured out, if you put between the two rafts a regular wheel, a paddle wheel, you know, you have the wheel is turning. Now, you can do it as wide as you want. You can regulate it. And, of course, the heavier and the wider, the more energy you get. Now, to illustrate that, it's very big. It goes up to... It was built in a factory, and it shows two of my erotic frogs. You know. And it's just coming now back from China. The French took that and showed it in Shanghai at the World's Fair. I mean, usually, I think it was the only fun thing there. I mean, you know, you need a bit of humor in this world. And they're sexy, you know, because what I like about frogs, they have beautiful legs, you know. All they need is black stockings.
Can you please tell us about something you're not interested in?
Hate.
Great.
I hate.
Well, it is...
But otherwise, it's the whole life is a safari. You know, just every day you learn something, you find out about something. So just your friend last night was telling me things about cement, which I didn't know. Now he's right over there, sitting there, and now I'm going to read the book, and, you know, I never thought of making any research, because, you know, I mean, in our world, especially nowadays, we take everything for granted. But just to find out where something comes from, it's fascinating. Every object is a little safari. You can take anything. Glass blowing, weaving.
but you're not interested in computers.
Oh, no, that's right. Thank you. No, no, look here, I would if I had the ability. You know, it's confusing me. And with one eye, I mean, I don't get a clear picture on the screen. And it's a bit late in my life. I mean, this is another world. I wish I were. But then on the other hand, you know, when I need information, I have all my books and my dictionaries, and I'd rather look for it than having it given. And you have the same thing with television, you know. I mean, you can watch the most wonderful movie about insects or animals and all that, and after that, do you remember the name of the insect they were talking about it? I don't, because it goes too fast. Mm-hmm. But if I look up this insect and read up into a book and the whole thing, then it stays. So we really live in a very quite ephemeral world, which is accelerating all the time. Everything is getting faster. What makes Sami run, I'd like to know. So that would be the answer. And I never had any talent with this. You know, I like to work tools, but I even to this day miss the old telephone, you know, that went around like that. And
But when you lived in Nova Scotia,
yeah,
you were totally self-sufficient. You
yeah,
butchered
yeah.
your own
yeah,
animals, you
yeah.
raised your own food.
Yeah, that's why I'm very happy that the book I wrote at about this time, quite a while back, is reprinted. It came out in the States, but it was Grove Press in those days, and then it's been forgotten. And now it's called Far Out Is Not Far Enough. And I'm very happy. It's just being published again. I'm very lucky that I found a wonderful publisher with Phaidon. And it's really thanks to Phaidon that I'm back here. They are publishing a lot of my books and quite a few at a... It's quite daring, you know, to bring out 4 or 5 titles in 1 year. But we'll see if it's worth it. But you see, I have no right to complain. I'm translating in over 30 languages, you know, all over the place. But it's really ironical that for all those years I was not in English. This was my Korean publisher who wanted to publish me in English, so... I was just there completely sounds absolutely outrageous, but you never know.
It must be useful when you're drawing a pig in a children's book to have actually lived, butchered, and eaten pigs.
Yeah, later on, yeah. I've and a lot of animals. We came there in Canada, and... the food was so terrible, so we decided to buy a pig, and there was no butcher, so I had to go through it. I had a little manual, you know, from Morton Salt, you know, about butchering. I just had a diagram of where to stick the knife, and it worked perfectly. It works well. I mean, and then from one animal to the other, and... I couldn't do it anymore. It's really, it's kind of against my... But it was a challenge, you see. I mean, I love the challenge. I'll do anything for a challenge. It's, I mean, I don't regret it, but I couldn't do it anymore. I will say, you know, when I was a child, I've been, you know, it's ironical because I've been for 1 year elected in Europe, I would say honorary president of the... I say for the animals, the Association for the Safety of Animals, the
SPCA.
SPCA. Yeah. I was an honorary, you know, because
that's another. Ever elected to that?
No, that's another cause. I did a book called Amnesty Animal. I did a book called Amnesty Animal, so about animal cruelty and all that. And it's very funny because when I was, you know, honored, I had to hold a speech, and I told them how I killed the pig, you know. But I said at least it was a happy pig.
Well, I think the plan now is to open this up to questions from the audience, and I think Andy's going to MC that part of it.
So thank you all for coming. The way this works is you put your hand up, we'll call on you. Please wait for the mic. Who would like to start us off? I understand we've got some ringers tonight, so we might go right to you. The first, second row here.
Well, just a quick question of why Ireland now?
Well, it was just like this. I mean, if you read my Canada book, you will understand why we left. We arrived there at most likely the only place in Canada where the police station was boarded because they couldn't control the place anymore. I mean, actually, it was not a place to bring up children. And my wife and I, we decided to have a family. And suddenly, you know, old friends like my friend Brian Moore, the writer from Ireland, you know, as I always say, you have to give destiny a destination, and that just signs you. You sign it. Like suddenly it was enough with New York. We just packed and went for Canada, and just the same thing, we went for Ireland. And we went there, and we fell in love with it. Because I need the ocean. I need the ocean. I have a love affair with the horizon line, the waves, the storms. And Ireland was just happened to be the right place. And we then came back. My wife was, 8 months pregnant. And we came back with 6 suitcases just to be sure that first child would be born and baptized in Ireland. And that was that. And that's been my country of choice ever since. Especially for me, Alsatian, you know. It was back to the continent. And it's easy to just go over there. But you know, Ireland is in the ocean. It's not between France and Germany, in a way, you know. But I still, you know, I still have my mother's apartment in Strasbourg, so I spend about a great deal of my time in Strasbourg. I'm active, too, in the European Council and all those things. But anyway, I think Ireland, after Ireland, there was, for me, no desire anymore to go anywhere else. It's really a love affair. I love Ireland.
Another question?
But when you say you love a country, it's because you love the people. You know, so.
Right here in the second row, Reese.
Mr. Unger, would you talk a little about religion?
You can call me Tommy because we met already last night.
Mea culpa, mea culpa.
About religion. Yeah, well, that's a very good point. It's a subject that I find very close to me. I was brought up very strictly Protestant. I'm really talking in a Puritan way, you know. Read my childhood memories, you know, after my father's death and all that, I was left with my uncle who was an evangelist. And he would come and sneak at night in my room and steal my drawing and destroy them. Because he said that God made man after his own image, that my caricatures were a sin because it was insulting. Which I can understand his point of view. But just to say that I was brought up in a very... And then, you know, in life, I found out there were other religions, you know, and I just find it very interesting. As a child, I desperately tried to find grace. I would pray on my knees, you know, asking, and I was not given the faith that I wanted, but I certainly do respect it. You know, it helps a lot of people. So I do pray every day. I'm only to say thank you. I don't know who I'm praying to. But I would say it's very important to keep one's gratitude, you know, even if you don't know where it's going and where it's landing. And it, you know, it's incredible. I mean, just to have a glass of water, do you realize what a luxury that can be for others? So I think if you are grateful and you respect others, and, well, you have your religion there. And if, and you know, I mean, what is religion? What is faith? I mean, I find spirituality in nature, you know, just one tree, just one tree. Just to put your back against one tree and feel the energy it gives you. But as I said, I mean, very early I had to deal with my doubt. And there again, my doubt makes me much more open to all the other religions. You know, it's actually fascinating to have an open mind. An open mind is, one doesn't have only one mind, you have many minds. For every mind, you have a window or a door. This is fantastic, you know. Sometimes you can shut the shutters for a while, then they open up again. And so that would be the answer. I mean, look here, I mean, the only thing that I regret in religion or anything else is when it reaches fanaticism. Then it's out. And it's incredible that everything in this world can lead to fanaticism. I mean, this is... sometimes you really wonder, but the human condition, la condition humaine. Voilà.
Why don't we open another window? Who has another question? Ringers? All the way in back in the red, I believe that's Adrian.
So I know that Fiden is republishing your back catalog. Are you working on anything new right now?
Oh, my God, yes. You know, I mean, I'm overrun with ideas, projects. And as I was saying, you know, I've got only that many years left, so I better pack it. So right now I've got at least about 10 books which are not finished. And I just finished a children's book about just before I left for America. For Fiden. And right now I'm doing, my autobiography comes in different books, you know, but I haven't done America. I'm writing my America years now. And now this kind of answers your question a little while ago. It's very interesting to come back here and check and compare. And I feel a bit like Moon Man returning to Earth, you know. I was worried, and now I'm not, because I was already now 10 days in New York City. It was just wonderful, but for the new skyscrapers. But it's whenever you're in a place and you meet people smiling, it's changed. It makes you feel good, and this is. I must say, really, the amount of people who are smiling in New York, and my God, life is not that easy for everybody. I mean, and I'd come up with a kind of a theory that this has become such a pot of food, a stew of so many races. It's unbelievable. People coming from everywhere in the world. You know, and my maid in the hotel was Chinese, could hardly understand a word of English, but she had a wonderful smile, and that's all you need in the end. You know, that's great. So I was worried about coming back, but now I'm delighted I came. Absolutely. From my heart.
Well, I think that's where we'll end it. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.